Hello, I'm Thomas Davis. I'm the minister in Carloway Free Church in the Isle of Lewis in the northwest of Scotland.
And I'm Anne MacDonald, the student and young adult worker at Bon Accord Free Church in Aberdeen.
And I'm Andy Longway, minister of London City Presbyterian Church in London. And welcome to the Jesus Today podcast.
We've got another episode for you today, and it's great to have you with us. We have to go straight in, though, to talk about our last episode, where we had a big debate about chocolate. And in order to try and settle this, we had a poll online. Thank you to everybody who clicked on our poll that was on X as to the best chocolate. And I am very disappointed because Andy won.
Of course. Hands down the winner.
Hands down the winner is right. So just to explain, last time we had, we had Mark and Lisa Randall with us for the last podcast. If you didn't hear it, they gave us some fantastic wisdom about marriage. So please do go back and listen to that if you can. But as in our She's Right, I'm Wrong debate, we were all talking about the best chocolate, British chocolate, continental chocolate, American chocolate. We had a poll. Anne didn't even get on the poll because we were only like four. So, Anne, what was your chocolate? Was some black cherry thing?
Yeah, it's a bit obscure. Montezuma, I think it's called.
Montezuma's
dark cherry chocolate.
That. Well, we couldn't spell that, so we put it down
obviously, that would have won if it had been in the running.
Well, yeah, obviously. And then Lisa had I think dark chocolate. It was bottom. Not many chose that. Mark went for classic American Reese's, but again, support for that was not high. I had gone for Toblerone, which is obviously the strongest contender, but I only came in with about, I think, 25% of the votes, and Andy's Dairy Milk, over 50% of the vote. It was like the Brexit referendum. The result comes in and everyone's gutted.
But Anne, did I hear that someone got you a gift?
Yeah, so I feel fine about this. I feel like I won. I got amazing, and not the Reese's peanut butter cups, but Pippin Nut peanut butter cups, and they are fantastic. So they resolve the whole issue of the problematic chocolate on the Reese's cups. So
fantastic.
If they were in the running, they'd have won.
brilliant. Well, thank you to everyone for taking part of that. Thank you to everyone for keeping in touch. And we are so grateful to hear from you. And it means so much when people express their appreciation for the podcast. And we are so, so thankful to you for that. And a reminder that you can connect with us on social media. You can just look for Jesus Today Pod on X, or you can search Jesus Today Podcast on Facebook or Instagram. You'll find us there. And you can email us at hello@jesustodaypodcast.com.
Well, before we get to our topic today, which we're going to be thinking about the image of God, I think we should play our game.
Yes.
He's right, she's wrong.
Change the title there, Andy.
And Thomas, you're heading to the States next week, and let's use that, right? So what about our favorite mode of transport? So plane, car,
I am indeed going to the States in just a few days' time, which is, it's very exciting. Very, very privileged to go across and see friends over there. So I've got to take lots of planes, got to fly. But plane is not my favourite form of transport. Probably the biggest reason is leg room. That's just a big problem for me in a plane. Those of you who've met me will know that I'm quite tall. And getting on a plane and my knees are sticking into the seat in front of me, and it's just not that comfortable. So planes, I don't love. For me, my favorite mode of transport, living on an island, I've got to say the ferry. The ferry is just very, very cool. Now, having said that, not cool when it's rough. That's true. It can be a wee bit unpleasant, but it's not that bad really. And you know, on a nice day, getting on the ferry, just plenty leg room, you can walk about, beautiful view, smell the sea air, and on the Caledonian McBain ferries, you get an amazing fry up for breakfast. You don't get that in the plane, you don't get that anywhere else, so I'm voting ferry for best form of transport.
Oh no, Thomas. I just, even on a good day, I just psychologically feel seasick on a ferry. I just can't. I don't know how you enjoy that, but I think train is very civilized. Okay. You can get work done. You can be productive on the train or just read a good book. And, you know, typically you can even get a good coffee, not on the train, but in the train station or very near, yeah, and get some nice snacks. And it's just very civilized. By the time you arrive at your destination, you can feel like productive. I've done my work. I can enjoy my time here. So train.
True. Andy.
Mm-hmm. I do like trains, but I want to just argue against you, Thomas. So I'm going to go for planes. Like, I think it's the fastest mode of travel that we can take, right? So speed, you're going hundreds of miles an hour. The reason I really like planes is that feeling of just traveling, going on an adventure, you know, as the plane takes off and you're in the sky. Mm. I just love that feeling. I even love coming home, flying back home into like London and just seeing the city and thinking, I'm home, this is great. Yeah. I love that feeling. I love the feeling that you get in planes as well, that, you know, I think they're probably up there with the safest mode of transport, because so much safety work is, you know, carried out on these planes. You know, there's very, very low risk of something bad going wrong because they check them all the time.
Obviously, but when it does, Andy, it's really wrong.
Then comfort, right? You can watch your favorite film, watch TV programs, you get a meal brought to you, you get coffee brought to you.
Do you travel first class, Andy? That sounds good.
And there is that, of course.
The free church minister salary.
So I'm going to say planes and global connectivity. Beat that one, right? And you cannot travel the world in a train.
I suppose Thomas and I would have to team together to travel the world.
Yeah, exactly. I can travel the world, just not quickly. It's just very slow. Like Andy flies off to the conference and I get on the ferry and I arrive 3 weeks after the conference. So Oh, dear me. Well, listeners, which one do you prefer? Planes, trains, ferry, anything we've forgotten? Maybe bus? Surely not bus. But it could be. But yeah, we'd love to hear your favorite form of transport. And when I come back from America, I can tell you all about the poor leg room and the fact that American Airlines breakfast is nowhere near as good as a CalMac breakfast.
Well, today we're thinking about following Jesus and thinking about following Jesus in relation to who we are as human beings and who he's made us to be as image bearers. I once heard this story. I think it was like a professor was speaking at a conference and he stood up and he asked the auditorium, what is man? And he said, it's not a rhetorical question. And so they all shouted back, and the overwhelming shout back was, totally depraved. And he was kind of stunned at that and said, now you're starting in the wrong place. If you start thinking of human beings only as sinners, fundamentally, you've started in the wrong place, because Genesis 1 says that we are made in the image of God. So to get us going, Anne, Thomas, let's get a definition of what does it mean to be made in the image of God?
Well, I think when I think of defining what does it mean to be in the image of God, I think of two things. I think of the fact that we are made to resemble God, and we are made to represent God. And so I think, and I find those two words helpful, and I think the two aspects of it are quite important, because when you see, you know, when you read Genesis 1 and 2, I think that there is the sense in which we resemble God in a way that no other part of creation does. And I think that is really crucial for us to remember, that there are things about humanity, and we'll maybe dig into these shortly, that resemble God. And so there's things that we see in us and in one another that reveal to us what God is like. I remember hearing Ed Clowney, he's passed away now, but he was a professor and writer in the USA, talking about this. And he said, you know, you can look up on a starry night and say, the heavens declare the glory of God. But he said, you have to look in the mirror to see something that bears the image of God. And I thought, oh wow, you know, that is, that's amazing. So that, that the heavens don't do what you do. You bear the image of God. So there's a sense in which we resemble God, and there's lots of aspects of us that does that, I think. But I think there's also the aspect whereby we represent God. And you see that in the role that we have, the role given to Adam to have dominion, to fill the earth. And I think that that's a key aspect of bearing God's image as well, the fact that we function as his representative. He delegates authority and responsibility to us. And responsibility is a massive aspect of bearing God's image. So those two things, we resemble God, we represent God in a unique way. It's, I think, helpful to understand what we mean by that.
Yeah, that's really helpful, Thomas. And the resembling part, you can see so much, like you're saying, it's not so much physically as you look in the mirror that you see God resembled, but in our need for relationships is one that just comes to mind straight away, just that God is Trinity and that beautiful community. And you can see that to different degrees in different people, but all of us have that need to love and to be loved. Yeah. And that's kind of that inbuilt mark of being in God's image that is so beautiful.
Exactly,
I think.
Exactly. And it makes Genesis 3 kind of all the more perplexing and tragic because Satan says, you know, you'll be like God. And of course, the answer, the theological answer to that is, I already am. I don't need to take that fruit to be like God. I already am. But of course, that's what was forgotten. Yeah,
that's good. I remember, so in Genesis 1, you know, how God makes us like set apart from all of creation. You know, he's like, let there be light, let there be waters, let there be. And then it's let us make. It's not just that let there be. It is let us make. And then it's let us make man in our image, male and female. He created them. He in his own likeness. And every time he's chatting about the other created things, it's according to their own. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds. Then he says the same about the animals. But when it comes to humanity, it is let us make them in our image according to our likeness. So we truly are set apart from the rest of creation. One of the amazing aspects of that is that God then communicates to Adam and Eve with words, and they can communicate back. So that whole relational dimension is at the very heart of being an image bearer. We both can receive love, we can give love, we can show love to one another, and that is the reflection of being made in the image of a triune God who is at the heart of his nature, love. And so I just think that the most amazing thing, you know, with as we define this, is the relational aspect. And then, as both of you said, just the, or that other aspect of we represent God. He's given us purpose, dominion, to have authority, to cultivate and till the earth. Just that purpose in his creation. He's blessed us with the ability to be childbearing and wanting the image of God to spread across creation so that he himself receives all the glory. I'm sure there's much more that could be said, but I think maybe that, yeah, that's a good way. Let's think about the image of God, right? Not from a Christian point of view, but just are there areas in common grace we get to see how people appreciate this reality that we are made in God's image, or we have value, dignity, and worth elsewhere?
Yeah, I think in our culture, especially, you know, even if you were, if you would consider yourself a humanist, for example, you would hold to the belief that every human being is of equal value and worth. And there is this, and I don't think it is natural, actually. I was going to say a natural instinct, but I think if we look at history, we can see it really isn't a natural instinct. But like Tom Holland, the historian, have you come across Tom Holland, the historian? He talks about how we live now in a Christian society. We're so shaped by the fact that Christianity has made such a mark on our culture that we just assume that every human being is of value, even those who are voiceless and oppressed. But if we look further back in history to the context where the early church came into being, especially that Roman Greco culture, that just was not assumed. You know, women, children, slaves were seen as subhuman or certainly on a different level to the man of the house.
Yeah.
But now we've been so kind of swimming in the waters of Christianity that I think our culture really does value that principle that each human being, there is an intrinsic value and dignity. But I just don't think that people necessarily follow the logic through. I was hearing about, do you know Yuval Noah Harari? Have you come across him? He's the guy who wrote the book Sapiens. He's like an atheist guy.
Yeah, okay.
And he was doing a TED talk where he was talking about what actually human rights are not something that is a given. And, you know, if you cut open a human being, you don't find human rights. You find, you know, organs and blood and things like that. There's no, he, you know, he's like on a scientific basis. So he's really helpful because he is actually consistent. Yes, and he kind of highlights the issue that if you do assume this belief that human beings are of equal value and dignity and worth, then you're not getting that from an atheistic worldview. And you've got to kind of examine that.
That's such an interesting thing to think about, because, you know, you would absolutely, and I think we would rightly say that it's a really good thing in our society today that sense of equality is recognized and it's upheld. But it is fascinating when you have to start sort of pushing people to think, well, where does that come from?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why I find the Bible so intellectually satisfying. I often say that it's something so intellectually satisfying, because you can see, well, like, I know that the equality of all people is so crucial. And then the Bible gives me a basis for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives me a really coherent basis for that. In fact, it gives me that on page one of the Bible, the fact that we're made in God's image. And I love the fact that, you know, the Bible is so explicit on page one of something written thousands of years ago in all the kind of very ancient male-dominated societies, that you have that emphasis on male and female made in God's image. Fantastic just to have that right there on page one.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people have misconceptions about that, about the Bible, especially when, you know, maybe some of the familiar stories or things, I don't know if you've come across The Handmaid's Tale, you know, the Margaret Atwood novel that's been made into a TV series, and then there's all this, it's, you know, lots made of Abraham and Hagar and that horrific story in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, a religious order that kind of is like claiming this is a biblical idea. But actually, by putting that idea of we are all made in the image of God on the first page of the Bible, we're not meant to read Abraham's actions, for example, as this is what you're supposed to do. We're meant to read them with horror and be like, what are you doing? You know, it's just the way we're meant to read God's word is in the context of the biblical story. And when we take it out of that and we lose, like you were saying, Andy, at the beginning, if we start with the wrong point, we get in a complete, really dangerous muddle. And
absolutely. And I really like the fact that, just going back to something you said, and it triggered something, you know, Tom Holland's view that today we live in a sort of Christian society the reality is that so many of our laws, especially our rights, they're appropriating from the Judeo-Christian worldview. So enshrined in law is the equality of male and female, the freedom of expression, all of these things. And if you look at them, the place where they purchased all of those rights from was the Bible. And so we as Christians need to know that, you know, we've got confidence as we seek to live in this world that God has made us gloriously in his image, given us dignity, value, and worth. But then we need to follow through the logic where perhaps sometimes I actually think that even as Christians, we can be as inconsistent with our worldview.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not uncommon in the church to find people being discriminated against based on whatever the factor might be, gender, race.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because we've got an underdeveloped doctrine of the image of God. And I think the other thing to say is that, you know, you read through this, I think, or maybe two things to say, you read through the scriptures and you find someone like David and Psalm 8 so amazed of who he is. You know, you look at the stars and you're like, wow, what an amazing God we are. And then he's like, but I look at man, and that God is mindful of him and crowned him with glory and honor. That is absolutely incredible. And then the other thought I had was, I think in our tradition, just say the Scottish Reformed tradition, one thing that we've heard preached from pulpits is we're the dust of the earth. We're the worm of the earth. Mm. And sometimes that can kind of just kind of give you this worldview that you're nothing in comparison to God, which there's definitely the creator-creature distinction. But sometimes it leads us to actually have a very underdeveloped understanding. No, God made us with worth and value. Mm-hmm. And we're immortal. We're made in his image. We're going to live forever. Mm-hmm. And that is a truly mind-blowing and life-changing conviction to hold. And how do we work that out as followers of Jesus in our daily life?
Yeah, I totally agree, Andy. And I think actually if we do lose that sense of the value, you know, because we're so rightly wanting to convey the idea of our total depravity and our sinfulness, which we have to hold in tension. But if we lose sight of that value and dignity, then we can't even love our neighbor as we love ourselves. You know, we can't love well if we're not aware of the worth and the value and the dignity that we have by virtue of being an image bearer of God. And then a whole other layer, well, that kind of, that very value redeemed in Christ is an even deeper layer of value and worth that we see there. But
yeah, I think that's so helpful to think through, because this is something that can really affect both how we view ourselves and how we view other people. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's just a Scottish thing, but we're all prone to be like lean on the side of negative. And if you can think of what's the negative way of viewing this, that's definitely something that we can apply to ourselves, and it's definitely something that we can apply to other people. And it's interesting because you see the world around us trying to fight against this, that, you know, so many people are looking for something that will bring self-worth, value. And often that gets rooted into, you know, a very individualized sense of identity, mm-hmm. you know, being who I am, being me, being true to myself, and all that kind of language to try and build a sense of self-worth. And, you know, you can see it's so fragile because it's actually mm-hmm. something that's been sort of strung together that has no real basis. The doctrine of being made in the image of God is so different because mm-hmm. you know your self-worth and value is actually rooted in what something else or what someone else has done. Mm-hmm. It's like God is like, I've made you. Mm-hmm. You were my idea, my plan, my delight. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such a beautiful thing for finding our own sense of self-worth, especially in a world just now which does so much to destroy our sense of self-worth and by comparing to others. But yet there's also the other side of it, that it has to shape the way I view other people, because, you know, we can easily be negative when we look at ourselves. We can easily be very, very negative when we view others, see others as a threat, see others as competitors, difficult, whatever it might be. And actually, you know, for page one in our view of other people, to be there, they've been made in the image of God, mm-hmm. I think is just so crucial for shaping our relationships, both at a personal friendship level, but also even how we view other people groups, other nations, other mm-hmm. races, all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. It shapes all of that.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, holding tight to the image of God makes you see everyone as equal. Mm. And the more we lose that, the more we other people. Like, yeah. We see everyone as the same as us if we hold tight to that doctrine. But we see people as other if we lose sight of it. And that's when dangerous behaviours can happen.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Mm. Exactly. What about, can I ask you guys, obviously, though, you know, it's not the whole story about humanity, you know, that, mm-hmm. that when we say we're made the image of God, and how do we recognize and acknowledge the fact that yes, we are made in the image of God, but we're no longer what we were made to be, mm-hmm. And there's something wrong with us, and how are some of the ways that maybe shows itself, or we need to unpack that too a wee bit.
So with the fall, it was extensive, mm-hmm. you know. I love that line that Thomas, you said, that, you know, Adam and Eve, already had that knowledge of God because they were made in the image of God. And so Satan's temptation is so just adds to the wickedness of the whole fall. It truly was a fall when that which they had, they succumbed to and been offered to them. But one thing that's clear, that just because Adam and Eve fell into sin and brought sin into the world, that we've not lost the image of God, but it's marred.
Yeah.
It's been ruined, but we still possess it, so much so that, you know, is it Genesis 6 and 7 and 8, where God is commanding Noah, he says to him, you know, the reason why life is so important is because we've been made in the image of God. And that principle's picked up in James, you know, we can curse man. The same mouth that, you know, praises God, curses man, made in the image of God. And so it's a reality that we're made in the image of God. But because of the fall, we now are sinners. We're not the way we're supposed to be. And we don't reflect God the way we're supposed to be. We're supposed to. Because of the bondage of our sin, the bondage of our will towards sin, our propensity is not to do that which we were created for. So to live for God's glory, we're now turned inward. We live for our own glory instead of, giving God the glory he was supposed to. We've exchanged it for a lie, and instead of worshiping him, we worship the created. And so I think, tragically, when we've lost the glory that we were actually originally made with, it only adds even more to how spectacular the fall is, because we now worship something that's not glorious as it was meant.
So my husband Rob used to do this children's talk way, way back. He probably can't do it anymore because money has changed. Let me explain why that has an impact on it.
Is he 140 years old?
Killings.
Before notes became all plasticky, you know, how they're like, they kind of jump out your pocket because they're so sturdy now.
Yeah.
When they were kind of still papery, he used to do this children's talk where he'd take a £20 note or something like that, and then he would like tear it a bit, scrumple it up, step on it, get it a bit dirty, and the children would be watching going, oh, what are you doing? And then, you know, he would say how this had £20 worth of value because it said it on it. And then even after this process of damaging it and making it all horrible and broken, he's like, it still has the same value. And I just thought that's quite helpful, you know, that doesn't take away the fact that we are broken and we are sinners, but the value, we still have that intrinsic value. Because we bear the image, just like the note that wore the image of the queen at that point. We bear the image of God, and that's where value comes from.
Yeah, that's a brilliant illustration. I was going to steal that, but I've just realized I can't with the money because it's plastic. So that's a great idea. I thought that's very, very good. I think it's really interesting as well that one aspect of thinking about being made in the image of God, I think it has important implications for just some really general parts of life as well. You know, you think about, you know, if you're studying maybe your school or at college or university, or if you're thinking about just the job you do, whatever that job might be, or even the hobbies that you have, you know, actually being able to do these things, being able to achieve things and accomplish things and use the capacities and skills that we have for these purposes, all of that's reflecting the fact that we're made in the image of God. And I always think it's really good to sort of to ask yourself the questions, you know, what can humans do that no other part of creation can? And there's so many amazing things that humanity can do. And I think that it's, and of course, you know, the other side of that is that there's so many awful things that only humanity does, you know, and the rest of creation doesn't. And that tension is always there. But I guess I want to kind of just major on the positive aspect of it, to remember that as we follow Jesus today, you know, going to my job, you know, going to my classes or lectures, going to my hobby, this is an opportunity to display the fact that God's given us wonderful capabilities, and we can enjoy and appreciate them and return them in thanks to him for making us with these abilities.
Yeah, because creativity is a massive part of God's image in us, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we are creative creators, because he is the creator.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think it's so crucial to keep coming back to that. But yet I think the kind of one of the big tragedies of sin, I remember one of these things I never really realized until it was explained to me, that, you know, one of the things that makes sin so awful is that we're actually using these capabilities to push God away. So, you know, sin isn't just turning away from God. It's actually using the gifts and capabilities that God has given us to reject him and replace him with something else. And I was thinking recently about the whole question of idolatry, and there's a very famous description of idolatry given by John Calvin. He talks about the heart, human heart, as an idol factory. And it's a really helpful image, because you think, well, you know, we make idols in our heart, and that's really true. But when I actually went and read Calvin talking about it, he actually added more detail, which I found really helpful, because he was saying that, you know, our hearts are full of capabilities that God has given to us, and then we misuse them. So we're not just, our hearts aren't just idol factories because we succumb to idolatry, but they're idol factories because the tools are there, and the tools mm-hmm. were given by God. Mm-hmm. The tools for worship are in us. But instead of using them to serve and honor our Creator, we've used them to turn away from him.
And you see that in, like, one of the greatest areas of progress today. We see medical developments that are incredible. You know, we're living longer, we're living in some ways healthier lives than previous generations. But the very same medical areas of development can use their, whether it's for euthanasia or abortion, we can use the very capabilities that God has given us in evil ways. And one of the things that God takes really seriously in Scripture is that he's the one who gives and takes life. And not us.
And that's quite sobering, isn't it? You know, when you think of, you know, all the capabilities that have been displayed in humanity, especially in recent years, you just see incredible things that humanity's achieved. Mm-hmm. And yet you also see stuff like that you just think, how is that still happening? How do we do that? How can't we? I think was it you, Ant, talking earlier about, you know, thinking things through consistently and you know, how we can apply so much resources and skill and expertise and capability to help a sick child, mm-hmm. a sick baby, and yet at the same time we can't see that in the womb there's a precious human life that must be preserved and protected.
You know, that Sam says there's being wonderfully and fearfully made, you know, woven together in the womb. One of the things when I think of, say, just like the tragic reality that abortion can be is that it's the loss of a life that God is making. And
I think abortion is a really helpful lens to see how important this doctrine of the image of God is, because the question that kind of is at the heart of the abortion issue is what makes a human being. And, you know, when you're thinking that through without this intrinsic human value, then you're like, well, it's when the baby can feel pain, is it when the baby can reach a certain level of ability or viability outside of the womb, and you're defining humanity in all of these ways. And as we learn more and more about what goes on in the womb, that changes as well, the line of when this child is not considered human to when it is considered human. And if we don't have this all-encompassing just inherent value as soon as there's life, then there's everything kind of crumbles. And another, I don't know if you heard, have you heard of the, I think he's an Australian philosopher, Peter Singer. Mm-hmm. He's helpful in the same way as Yuval Noah Harari is helpful. His ideas are horrific, but they do show the logic, because he's like, well, you know, an unborn child can offer nothing to society. So his kind of definition of a human is the value, what they can contribute to society. Yeah. And he's saying, well, there's not much difference between an unborn child and a born child, if they're not going to, disability and things like that come into it. And it's absolutely and utterly abhorrent, but also, well, at least he's following through the logic and kind of shows how if you lose sight of this just intrinsic value of a human being that's not dependent on what this human can do or offer to society, then all kinds of horrors are possible. So yeah.
I think it's so important to recognize, and it just comes back to why it's just so amazing that this is page one of the Bible. It is page one of what we need to know about humanity. And another thing that I had never really thought of before until just a couple of years ago, reading some theologians who highlighted the fact that when we talk about the image of God, it's so important to think about that, so important for our own self-worth. But in our kind of very individualized society just now, I think it's very easy to think of it very much just in individualistic terms and to think, well, yeah, I take comfort and confidence in this, that I am made in the image of God. And that's so crucial. But the thing that was highlighted by the theologians I was reading was that the image of God is actually something that is only really properly born by humanity collectively.
Is that Herman Bavinck?
Yes. It's Herman Bavinck, yeah.
Yeah, that is one of his greatest quotes ever.
It's just amazing.
Yeah, so that's really good.
The image of God is not an I thing, it's a we thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something that we do. And it's like, oh, it's just brilliant, because that just brings together so many deep cravings that we have, like recognizing that actually we need each other, and we need each other to fulfill our purposes, and we need each other to thrive, and that collective togetherness is just it's just a vital part of who we are. And the actual kind of myth that, you know, all you need is yourself and all you need is what within you, it's just a myth. It's not true at all.
And if we apply that to the church, you know, the church finds its fullest expression when we showcase the manifold wisdom of God to the heavenly realms in our unity that is in a church that is diverse ages, diverse backgrounds, ethnicities. And, you know, one of the areas, right, let's think of common grace. I think where the culture perhaps is leading the church or is more advanced than the church in some areas is, say, the way that they treat disabled people. Huge conversations in the culture of why every public space needs disabled access, they need certain rooms, such like, and so on and so forth. And they'll work really hard to be thoughtful, and because they're saying they have got equal rights, they should have equal access.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you can go to the church, and in some of the most startling things is you can go to some churches and, you know, disabled people, say with serious disabilities, aren't there. And one of the questions is, why aren't they there? And is it because have we given the same thought and hospitality to loving them and making this as a place that's safe for them and enjoyable and comfortable for them? And that applies to so many different things. Like, you can have churches that become ageist, you know, let's put the focus all on the young people, let's cater everything to that sort of emphasis, and let's leave the elderly. But then again, are we thinking through, because all of us bear the image, because all of us have got that inherent dignity, worth and value, are we being so loving? Because the fullest expression of the image of God is not individual. It's not people just like me, people who've got my same, you know, whatever it is. The fullest expression of the image of God is in a collective humanity. And I remember Bavinck's quote is, like, you know, at the last, the Revelation 7 vision, all tribes, all tongues, all nations gathered, that is when we will see the image of God restored fully and finally. And it's in that common humanity that is diverse.
That's simultaneously such a beautiful image, and so shameful to think that as a church we are failing valuable image bearers in that way, and not really thinking through how can we make sure everybody here is seen and valued and treated with dignity and worth. It's a really challenging thought.
It is. Another place where I've been challenged on this one is, so as our regular listeners will know, I live in a rural place. I love rural places. Love living in just a tiny village in northwest of Scotland. Just magnificent. And it's so magnificently far away from London. It's just great. And yet I remember hearing Tim Keller talk about this, talking about the city. And he was speaking about Manhattan, but it applies to London, applies to any big urban area. He said, you know, there's more image of God per square inch in a place like Manhattan, in London, in Leith, in Edinburgh. You know, these densely populated areas, you know, this is where you have more image of God per square inch. He says, we've got to love that, and we've got to reach that, and we've got to long for that. And I was like, I just want to be on the moon with nobody. And, you know, it was actually challenging. I mean, and that's not to say, I mean, it's not a dichotomy. It's not, you know, we can look at God's creation, marvel at it and say, you know, look, Lord, your handiwork is amazing. But people like me, I can't turn my nose up at a busy city because I have to recognize, like, that's actually full of image bearers. And these are people that need to be reached. And that's why, you know, work like what both of you are doing in cities is just so massively important, because people need to be hearing the gospel. We need our cities, towns, villages, all shaped by the good news of Jesus.
I'm glad you said that, Thomas. No, but Thomas, I don't know if you remember our professor, Don McLeod, when he used to lecture, I remember one of his emphasis, I think one of his major emphasis in his teaching was the image of God. I can always remember that when he was chatting about us going out into the pastoral ministry, and he was thinking of the island rural context, he said, young men, one of your dangers is that you've got no life experience, and you're going to pastor people who've got way more life experience. And even in that rural congregation, he spoke about, like, you know, the woman who'd worked her whole life in the loom. She'd lost husband, lost son, lost brother. Don't you go in there undervaluing, place the emphasis that God would place in her, and you've got so much to learn from her. And I always remember that. He used to always struck me, he used to always place a value, because of his doctrine of the image of God, but press us in ways that were uncomfortable, or where you just wouldn't give, you know, you wouldn't give thought to.
Exactly. I think that's a great point. And you know, because it's so easy on the other way around, you know, for you know, when you're in the city, when you're near the universities, near Parliament, everything, to think, well, this is where life happens. This is where the country's taken forward. And it's easy to think of rural, you know, places as well, just as sort of a bit cut off, sometimes even a bit backward. But actually, you know, not like that. Yeah, there's so much in terms of life experience there.
See if I can just press one area, right, and I'm asking for advice. So I think one of the areas today where we see the devaluing of the image of God, especially in our culture, where we often objectify the opposite sex and lust being a huge issue. How does the doctrine of the image of God help us address sins like lust, for example?
That's so helpful. I was just thinking about how a massive part of the image of God is men and women together. You know, you were saying collectively we image God together, but there's a special way that men and women partnering with that equality and equal dignity and worth together. And I think that is so helpful. I was just thinking through about the church and how the church operates, and that the dynamic that we're given, or the lens that we're given to see each other through, is the brother-sister lens, and how that can transform everything. And I think as Christians, we're meant to look at the opposite sex as brother-sister, which completely impacts that lust question. You're not meant to look at the opposite sex as an object of lust, but a fellow image bearer, a brother or a sister in Christ in the Christian context, but just as an image bearer. So you're treating them as a whole person, because, you know, as soon as we're talking about things like pornography, things like that, you're just reducing a human, an image bearer, to an object. And that's just, you know, so damaging and goes completely against God's design for human beings.
Absolutely. And because it's almost like you just are, you know, lust, pornography, that kind of thing, you're just consuming, even devouring, you know, somebody else to satisfy a sinful craving and appetite. And there's just, it's such a, like you say, such a devaluing of an image bearer, and such a degrading for humanity. And, you know, sometimes I've heard somebody say, you know, when we think about lust and pornography and all that kind of stuff, to think in terms of, you know, what, you know, so say it's a girl, whatever, being looked at, what would their father think of that? What would their mother, how would their mother, how would their granny feel about that? And you think of, like the kind of family connection of how just appalled I am at the thought of my children ever being in that. And, you know, again, like image of God stuff takes us back to the fact that, well, actually, you know, God is our creator. There's that, you know, that our ultimate family identity is in him, you know, and mm-hmm. and for him to be our heavenly father, for and to see things in that light, I think reshapes us. Well, should hopefully yeah. surely reshape us and make us think more carefully.
I think the reason why it's so important that we think and we try and develop our doctrine of the image of God is because of that whole process of recalibrating our minds to that which God is, or the way that God has called us to think of ourselves mm-hmm. and one another. Mm-hmm. And we don't do that enough. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the one of the big glaring areas when I think of the image of God today, where I can think of its sins, is that some of my favorite theologians from history wrote some incredible volumes on the image of God, whilst at the exact same time being involved in the transatlantic slave trade. Mm. And you can stand back and say they were able to put pen to paper and say, to be made in the image of God is to be made with an inherent dignity, value, equality, beauty, mm. and goodness, and to reflect God's justice, at the same time as having no regard yeah. for a fellow human, yeah. for a fellow image bearer, and not seeing the inconsistency.
Yeah.
And one of the big things that teaches us is that even as redeemed saints, mm-hmm. we can have a flawed application
yeah.
of
yeah.
what does it mean to live as a follower of Jesus, as someone who's being restored into the and renewed into the image of our yeah. Creator and Savior. And so we need to think deeply about it mm-hmm. and apply it to our lives. And I think that, you know, when we just, even when we use lust there, is that we live in a culture where God's given us the ability to communicate with one another, both at the intellectual level, the spiritual level, the emotional level. He's given us the ability with our eyes to see beauty, to enjoy all of these things. He's given us the taste buds to enjoy food and taste and senses, all of that. And the problem with the fall is that it's not that we are the worst we could possibly be as those who are totally depraved, is that every area of us has been marred by the fall. And so that mm-hmm. even the eyes that we behold beauty with, we can use those same eyes to objectify beauty mm-hmm. and then use it for our own pleasure. And that is not the way God intended
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
God intended yeah. us to use our eyes, yes, to enjoy it, give him the glory for it, but also to have that full-orbed understanding. This person is of value. I've got so much that I could learn from mm-hmm. them. And that's why, and you said there about, I think it's beautiful that Paul uses the image of family. Mm-hmm. Because it gets right to the very heart of where do you place value? So on your siblings or on your parents, we place immense value in a stereotypical home. Obviously, some of us might have real yeah. pains and difficulties with siblings or our parents, but just generally speaking, and I think one of the things that does is when Paul says we're to view each other as brother and sister, is that it places it in it's the illustration that gives so much meaning. I am my brother or sister's keeper. Mm-hmm. What a blessed reality to view you, Anne, as my sister in Christ. Mm-hmm. What a blessed reality to view you, Thomas, as my brother, because that gives you both so much meaning to me, and it just reminds us the level that God wants us to see each other. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the biggest problems is because we don't give that the doctrine of the image of God much thought, we then abdicate responsibilities of how we're to live as followers of Jesus, and we objectify, or we make each other, we vilify, we curse mm-hmm. man made in the image of God.
And yeah. Oh, that's so true. That point you're making about how we can have the right theology and understand it to like a very sophisticated degree, and yet not live it out. And it's maybe on a different level, but I think that creeps in when we live in a society where we interact with image bearers through technology, you know, like on the internet, for example, if you don't have that visual reminder that this is an image bearer in front of me, you can see even Christians treating other image bearers really abhorrently.
Yeah.
And I see it creeping in myself, you know, even a car, like in a car, I can be driving, oh, that person just whatever. And just thinking, I would never think or say that if that was if I was face to face with another human being, and I am, the reality is they are an image bearer in that car, but there's this detachment in our society. So we forget that actually we're interacting with image bearers, even in those contexts.
That's so true. And you know, it's interesting because I think it really takes us back to what is maybe one of the most important things to remember, that when we talk about, you know, image bearers, when we talk about the fact that it's on page one of the Bible, the solution though isn't actually for us to rediscover that or to re-remember that. The solution is that we need to be rescued from our brokenness. We need to be redeemed from the marred image that we have. And that just takes us right back to the fact that, you know, we just need Jesus. And at the heart of the gospel is Jesus coming to rescue us, to restore us, to conform us to his image. Mm-hmm. He is the ultimate image bearer. He is the image. He is God himself. Yeah. And bringing us into relationship with him, restoring us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the light of the gospel, then for our thinking to be renewed, then for our image bearing role to be re-established and restored. It's just another aspect of the fullness of what Jesus has come to do. Just amazing.
And I think that's what you just said is absolutely key and central, is that the redemption part that's so key in this is that God's plan of redemption, which was before the foundation of the earth, I've just been preaching in Romans 8, and he predestined us before, in his eternal decree, that we would be conformed to the image of his son, so that he would be the firstborn among many brothers, so that he would have the preeminence. And the beautiful reality is God made us in his image. And in the eternal decrees, knowing that the whole planet, the whole outworking of humanity and redemption, there was a fall and he would need to redeem us. But what I love is that the end that has been determined for us is we are going to see Christ, be made just like him. And C.S. Lewis said, you know, when we think about being glorified, you know, there's a verse in Matthew's gospel and it says, you know, we're going to shine like the sun. And he's got that famous sermon in The Weight of Glory where he says, there are no ordinary people. Mm-hmm. You've never talked to a mere mortal. Everybody that you talk with, you know, who you joke with, who you marry, who you snub, who you exploit, remember they are immortals. And there's, on that last day when we are made like Jesus, when we see him in that instant, C.S. Lewis is like, he tries to capture and says, you know, that fellow person that you might want to snub or exploit, just remember that one day that fellow person is something you might even be tempted to worship, in the sense that they're going to so look like Jesus. And I remember that in of itself, redemption, renewal by the Spirit, does recalibrate our mind. But the key, Thomas, that you highlighted there is redemption is the thing. He had to rescue us. And that process of redemption is that progressive work in our life. We're not made overnight perfect. We'll only be made perfect when we see him. Yeah, I think that's okay, the gospel.
Amazing, amazing, amazing. Thank you guys so much. So good to think that through. And we'd love to hear your own thoughts, listeners. And if you've got questions or comments or things like that, we'd just love to hear from you. We're so thankful for you to be keeping in touch.
So we're very thankful to be sponsored by Christian Focus. And I think, Andy, you've got a review of, is it Shared Life by Donald MacLeod? Would you like to tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned earlier, he was our Thomas and I's professor. We just absolutely loved him and so miss him. So this has been published by Christian Focus because this is the 30th year anniversary edition. So he published Shared Life 30 years ago, and just testament to his writings, this book is just as applicable and relevant today as it was when it was first published. And I think it's going to be an enduring work for the church. And it's so, so good because it's simple. It's just vintage Donald MacLeod. It's practical, but it is profound. Like one of his big ideas is that the doctrine of the Trinity beckons us to our highest worship. And so he's got this great quote, if God were small enough to be understood, he would not be great enough to be worshipped. It would certainly be fatal to any doctrine of God that it contained nothing inscrutable. In Christianity, the central mystery is that God is triune, one being in three persons. And in this book, you know, he really, when he brings it to the practical level, he just opens up for us the shared life of the Trinity, but that we're invited into. and that even impacts our relationships within the context of the church and life. It's also so practical that he addresses issues of the worldview and the attacks that come from other religions like Judaism, Islam, mm-hmm. Mormonism, Jehovah's Witness. So it's a great book, a wonderful read, and actually a very simple read, so could not recommend this book anymore. Shared Life by Donald.
Well, I'm already a fan of Donald MacLeod now, so that'll be on my list.
Fantastic.
And what about you, Thomas? You've got another book to read.
I do. So alongside that 30-year-old book, 30-year anniversary book, I've got a book from Christian Focus, which is just brand new, out this year, and it's called Rebel to Your Will, and it's written by a pastor in America called Sean DeMarge, and it's really his own testimony. It's a short book, very easy to read. In fact, I read it on the ferry. Another wonderful thing about the ferry, you can just read books. I suppose you can read them on the plane and the boat. But anyway, the ferry's still better. So it's quite an easy read in the sense that it's short, it's clear. But it's also a hard read because he had a really hard story. And so he grew up and he suffered abuse from his mother. His mother was an addict. And it's just an amazingly open and honest story about how God saved him in all of that, how his own journey was one of abuse, but also how he then went down a path that was damaging himself. A line he uses several times is "hurt people hurt people." Hmm. You know, so people who've been hurt end up hurting others, and he saw that in his mother. He saw that in himself, but. An amazing testimony to God's grace. But what's interesting, though, is that it's not like he was converted and everything was fixed. He actually speaks a lot about, you know, how in his early years as a Christian, he was sucked in by the prosperity gospel and other aspects where, you know, mistakes he'd made, things he'd got wrong. And so it's just a beautiful story of God's grace. Interwoven in it all, there's very short chapters, you know, which we'll go back to his childhood and his upbringing, but interwoven in it all are then snippets of his life now, particularly his relationship with his own children and how beautiful that is in comparison to the gospel. And one of the reasons I wanted to highlight it for today was, you know, we're talking about the image of God, that dignity, and yet this book really brings home to you both just how much sin has damaged people and relationships and distorted things, but also that even in some of the darkest, hardest experiences, God's grace can reach us there, and Jesus's work of restoration can happen. So highly recommend it. Sean DeMarge, Rebel to Your Will. It's a really, really, yeah, really good book. Short and easy to read. So you can get both of them. Shared Life, Rebel to Your Will. Well worth getting.
There's my Easter holiday reading.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Speaking of Easter holidays, we will be, I think, taking a 1 or 2 week break. So it'll be maybe 3 or 4 weeks before the next episode comes out, and we'll take you through for the rest of season 3. So there'll be a wee break over Easter, but we'll be back mid-April, and we hope you have a wonderful holiday if you are taking any holidays just now, and we hope you just enjoy the great reminder of the good news of the resurrection over the Easter period, how we remember just how much God has done for us through his Son, our amazing Saviour, Jesus.